Would you say, it's my guess, you would know, that at the Laidlaw Foundation, you sort of pioneered this approach to foundation funding, which is to not provide good money to great programs, but that you would pick a goal or a target, and that in collaboration with the recipient, with the donee, and then you would help shape the program so that it wasn't about running around and raising profile and trying hard. It was about having a plan and working towards a goal and then recruiting assistance from other foundations and other environmental organizations. I remember, you know, I first started at CEDF, and it was 1988. It was a pollution probe for, I think, 87 to 88. I remember that foundations would talk to you about, well, we want to do some posters, and we want to, I'm going to fly up to Labrador, and we're going to raise some awareness, we're going to write a letter to the minister, and we're going to try and stop low flight training. And they'd write you a check, and they'd say, you know, give us a report at the end of the year. And that was sort of the end of their involvement. I always felt that Laidlaw took a slightly different approach, which was to say, well, we have these program areas, like we actually have program areas, and we're trying to accomplish something. And, you know, if you work with us and develop a campaign that will help us achieve this goal, then we're much more likely to make a bigger, longer-term commitment to you as opposed to kind of an ad hoc funding piece. And I thought that was very important because later, when we skip advanced to about 1999 or 2000, where foundations, in my opinion, turned an important corner where they actually started to either set direction or be partners in terms of strategic campaigns, advocacy campaigns, it was the Laidlaw that sort of laid the groundwork for that by sort of mucking around in the business of being co-creators of strategy or picking targets as opposed to just let's do some stuff. Is that
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, sort of thinking back, I remember there was always this kind of, I guess, tension in funding, and there were some funders, mostly in the United States, but McConnell would be the exception in Canada, who are the kind of the big theoretical social change funders. And so you'd have people saying, well, we shouldn't be funding projects, we should be just giving organizations capacity. So there's all these conversations about capacity funding, which frankly drove me mental, because I would like say, so capacity for what? Or I would ask foundations, so of all of your grants, which ones don't fund capacity? Okay, so we all fund capacity, so let's just stop talking about that. Now let's talk about what it is that we do fund and how we distinguish between our funding. And so where I landed at the Laidlaw Foundation was this idea that you can fund organizations, which is very nice. That's what organizations like. Write us a big check and don't tell us what to do with it. Or you can fund a project, which is, you know, we're going to write a report, say, you know, produce 10 pamphlets and have a meeting with the minister. Or where I landed was in the middle, which is a program, so programmatic funding. So you have shared objectives, you have shared outcomes, you have a long-term plan for what you're trying to accomplish. So, you know, shutting down coal plants, or even can be even more vague around, you know, our program, which is reducing exposure of children to environmental contaminants. At least you're on the same page. So it's like, so which piece of that are you working on as X organization? I would agree. I don't think there was a lot of that going on, certainly at the time, and even today it's there's not a whole lot. And then we've taken it kind of to almost the extreme level with the Ivy Foundation's involvement in the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, which is essentially all we do is fund one initiative. It's one big, you know, framework initiative with multiple grantees and industry and government and Aboriginal communities and scientists. It's a huge, huge thing, but every single person is on the same page working within a document that you can, you know, research with timelines and goals and everything. So that's kind of the culmination of, you know, really going from, you know, just firing off money for projects for good people doing good work to, okay, let's figure out how do we get people to collaborate. And the one thing actually that the three of us worked on, which I still think is one of the great examples of Foundation collaboration is the Greenbelt in Ontario, which...
Whoa, you're moving ahead too fast,
going too
Bruce.
Fast?
Oh, yeah, we still haven't
got
back to 1992. We still haven't got to 1992 yet, which
okay.
is... The reason why I have to interrupt you is that, you know, we were going great guns in Ontario and Canada, and for many, many years, the federal government was the big player in the environmental field, and the provinces were bit players. People forget that. But the action in the environment was mostly natural resource stuff. It was the big dams like the Old Man River Dam, the Raftery Alameda. It was the Daishawa pulp and paper mills. It was, you know, our kind of Arctic, you know, mineral exploration, and it was fishing, you know, believe it or not, when there's still fish.
Switch to red, or is it okay?
In Ontario, you know, thanks to, you know, John's cohort and the Peterson government, and even the Davis government before that with the Niagara Scarborough Commission and the development of the local and modern Ministry of the Environment, we were on a trajectory from about, you know, 1975 through, you know, 85 were going up, and then, you know, there was the so-called golden period where the MOE radically ramped up. We actually prosecuted polluters, courts mattered, environmental assessments mattered, there was intervener funding for a brief period. The MOE had some of the, you know, top flight lawyers, CELA was very robust, and then, you know, we got a majority government, things got even better, and then the NDP was elected, we got an environmental bill of rights, believe it or not, and everything just seemed to be golden. And then 1992 happened. Bob Rae decided that the environment was no longer his friend, and we went into a dark age in Ontario, where being an environmentalist was very difficult. And the EAs weren't that important anymore, and prosecutions had to pay for themselves. So that
actually is also that was the year the big timber EA concluded. Right, it was 91, I think.
92. But the report didn't come out until 94. So 2 years to write the report.
But the hearing was concluded, and the and what I was heavily involved in the demand supply plan hearing EA, which was.
Yeah.
Also concluded in, I think, 92.
I think 92 is right. Yes, yeah.
And that was kind of the end of big, and then, you know, long after Berger, but that was kind of the end of
the
heyday
of
EA.
It was the end of EA.
Yeah.
And it was also corresponding to the end of the activist role for the Ministry of the Environment prosecution branch. They just simply got out of the game of prosecuting. So I think it was in, I don't remember the year, but it might have been 90 or 91 or 89. Anyway, we collected $3.2 million in fines, and about 2 years later, we were down into the $600,000 range. I mean, it just stopped dead in its tracks because they decided to go with more of a sort of a voluntary approach, and things just changed. And then, of course, the Harris government was elected in 95.
And when was Kretschmann first elected?
I would say
93.
93? Yeah, I was going to say
93.
93, because he lost to Kim Campbell. I was on PEI with the ferry workers. We blockaded the Trans-Canada Highway and the Northumberland Strait, and that was October of 1993. That I won't forget.
Mm-hmm.
And he was elected.
Because I think that also coincided with a federal decline in environmental, all things environmental, was Kretschmann.
Mm. Well, Mulroney, as I recall, initiated SIA, which was a gutting of ERPGO. I mean, federal EA was on the same trajectory as the provincial EA, where, for example, the panel on the fixed link to PEI turned down the initial application. They said this, they turned it down, but they recommended against it. And that also had, the federal government said, we've lost control of our own mega project. How can we buy votes in regions if we can't control mega projects? And these EA panels are threatening that. And soon after, they gutted it. But in 95, Mike Harris was elected. I remember we had come in as the guest speaker, the new Minister of the Environment at CEDF. We used to host the annual fundraising dinner where all the environmental law crowd anyway would gather and talk. We had some pretty good speakers, you know, Suzuki and Andrew Petter and so on and so forth. Anyway, so came in, and she gave this speech. It was terrible. And then I went up to her EA, and I said, okay, listen, you know, we've been chatting, here's my business card, and we really look forward to working with you, so on and so forth. Here's my business card. He said, don't bother. I said, well, why not? He says, we're not going to be talking. And true to his word, we would call, and they wouldn't call us back. There was no dialogue whatsoever with the Minister of the Environment, no meeting, no, you know, no let's get to know each other, and then we won't talk, or Let's agree to disagree. There was nothing. I mean, they were absolutely positively contrary to everything having to do with the environment in Southern Ontario. They were pretty good with Lands for Life, but they wanted nothing to do with Southern Ontario until that kind of watershed of around 99, 2000. And then we get into Walkerton and the Oak Ridges Moraine.
Ipperwash?
Ipperwash, I think, was around that same time. I think it had less to do with the environment than Walkerton was a real wake-up call.
Sure.
But so was the land use battle up in Yonge East, Yonge West. It was a huge wake-up call and actually provoked Harris off the sidelines to intervene and stay that hearing. So I'm happy to go into the whole land use and green belt and the gist of all that. But it wasn't until around 2000, 99-2000, when what I'll call the modern land use environmental movement in Southern Ontario was born, that, you know, we see things like the Green Belt and Lake Simcoe Protection Act and a whole host of programs. But that started around 99-2000, and the foundations, I'll get into this in this period, were absolutely critical in pushing all that agenda along. So it's not the totality of the environmental story, but on that, all the land use stuff, the foundations were an essential partner in getting that done.
And there was a palpable decline in the environment too the year I started my consulting company. But right, like, you could just feel it, right? Everyone, we had meetings with foundations, I remember, all saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? No one's talking about the environment. We're having elections. No one cares. Environmental groups are off the map. It was, in terms of, you know, public awareness. So there was a real slowing down. Well, it coincided with as we're seeing sort of today with the economic recession between 92 and 94, I guess. 91 and 94, there was a big recession. So I think it was part of that big decline. So it took, I think that was part of the Laidlaw Foundation, our reevaluation when we moved out of the Great Lakes Conservation Program. It felt like things were shifting, like stuff we'd done, you know, the same strategies weren't working anymore, and the organizations were feeling a little tired, and it felt like there needed to be sort of a renewed thinking around the role of environmental groups, and I think we're in that same period right now. I think we're probably not coincidentally another economic downturn. But I think people all just stepping back, and, you know, everyone I talk to seems like they're rethinking their programming and where they're going and the role of NGOs and the, you know, failure of democracy and the lack of progress, government's not doing their job, that kind of thing. So
you skipped the glorious golden decade. How did you do that?
Yeah, no, I'm just, you know,
setting the scene.
2000 to 2012.
Right, the heyday.
Don't skip the good stuff.
But at the same time, it was, I still remember the Laidlaw Foundation, because we disbanded our committee, and in fact, I at the time, I recall that my feeling was that the environment program was hugely at risk at the Laidlaw Foundation, and I actually thought that there was a strong chance that they would completely abolish the environment program in 1995. It just felt like, you know, no one cared, and the people we were funding weren't really getting anywhere, and it was just, you know, the IJC was the other, I guess, the big thing that we were involved in, you know, around Great Lakes Conservation, and, you know, there was this big heyday of Great Lakes groups, and then it just felt like everything was going flat, and the IJC was becoming irrelevant, and both governments weren't caring. It was just like this, like, negativity everywhere you went. It was a killer, you know, bringing in some of the grantees to talk to our board or our committee, because they would come in, and I mean, you know, I love Paul Muldoon dearly, but Paul would come in and he'd be like, oh God, you know, it's a nightmare out there. We're just getting slaughtered. No one's listening to us. Everything we do is failing. And I'm like,
give us $50,000.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, another $50,000. We'll turn the corner. And of course, well, I'm going like, oh, great. And so, So then, of course, you have a board or you have a committee or people listening to this going, well, why are we bothering, right? Like, this is just seems futile. And so we were seriously, I think, at risk of the program being abolished. And I decided, well, fuck that. I'm going to just... And I sort of felt like I had nothing to lose at this point. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to completely redesign the program. All new thinking, all new people. And I'm going to get some people that I know will be highly respected to kind of help front the program on my behalf. Which so I turned to David Bell and Peter Victor, who were, I thought, you know, rather unassailable characters in dealing with these issues. And we created the new program at that. It's fun. This is fun because this brings back things I haven't thought about in a long time. And then so we did this kind of new program design, and David Bell sort of pitched it to the board, and the board thought this is fantastic. And so that's how we created the Children's Health and Environment Program. And then in the interim, there was this kind of downtime where we weren't really doing anything, and there wasn't really a program, and there wasn't any committees. And so it was in that downtime that we created the Sustainability Network and really got CEJAN going, because we weren't doing other stuff. And so I think so I'm a big fan of these kind of, you know, healthy resets where, you know, we go through this state of transition and there's a little bit of chaos, and then people start, you know, realigning in different ways, and then we send off again. And I think we're just on the verge of that, but I know we don't want to talk about that yet.
Well, one thing I would add to all that is that during that period, I think there was a decline in sort of what felt to me like a kind of a 70s, 80s approach to environmentalism in Ontario anyway, and probably in Canada, which was to, you know, law reform was a big part of that, engaging the process, working environmental assessment, the World Wildlife Fund stuff with the national parks and the land securement, that kind of started falling a little bit by the wayside because, frankly, it wasn't working. And whether it was the Chrétien government, the Mulroney government, or the Harris government, or even the Ray government, they weren't paying any attention to any of it anyway. With the success of the Temagami Wilderness Society and the Temagami campaign, people began to realize that more activism, backing up the policy piece and the EA and the court battles and using the media, was maybe a more effective strategy or as a way to circumvent process. And I felt, working in Toronto, but dealing with cases all across Canada, that it was a bit of a signal to people to sort of change their game a little bit, or maybe the activist organizations who were very small and almost, you know, marginalized, started to gain some acceptability in terms of their methods, and it started to work with people. And I remember it was probably 88 or 89, we had that brown ooze hanging over the city of Toronto, and it really awakened at the, because I was a canvasser for Pollution Probes. I remember knocking on people's doors saying, oh, I'm here organizing for Lake Ontario. I mean, I don't care about that, but look, I can't go out running. I can't do anything because there's so much pollution in the air coming from the Ohio Valley. What's that all about? I want something done about it. So there was a kind of a slow awakening where it was okay to be an environmental activist. You stopped being suspected of being a communist, and you became accepted as being someone who was public interest minded. You weren't just some weird left-wing communist. You actually wanted to make society better. And, you know, it started with the Temagami Wilderness Society and others. But by, you know, 99, 2000, one of the big campaigns that emerged for me was the fight over land use, the disappearing farmland. And it started in the Rouge River Valley with Save the Rouge, which was at one time considered to be, well, it was a blue chip organization. There are a lot of people there who have gone on, like, you know, Pauline Browse and you know, Glenda Baremaker, Councillor Glenda Baremaker, and you know, many of these people were on a trajectory to be quite respectable members of the community. But in those days, they were out dressing up in squirrel costumes and chopping up little, you know, pieces of the, so somebody went down and clear cut Bayview Avenue, right, to make way for the road expansion. Mm. Well, the Bear Maker and his crew went out and cut up these little logs and these little pieces. They drilled holes in them and then attached little flyers to a public meeting, to these chopped down trees in the right of way. And every, you know, resident around Richmond Hill got one of these things, and they had something like 2,000 people come out over several nights to talk about the expansion of Bayview Avenue and the proposal to put a massive new subdivision up on the very height of the Oak Ridges Moraine. And that touched off a debate about, all right, where are we going with public transit? How are we planning this urban sprawl? We're about to cut off this thing called the Oak Ridge Rail. Now, the storm was doing a fantastic job, you know, raising awareness, Deb Crandall and her group, raising awareness around the moraine, you know, doing public education, trying to do land securement, but it wasn't working. And then it all funneled down to this one land use hearing in Young East, Young West in Richmond Hill at the Ontario Municipal Board, when there was such activism on the part of these soccer moms in Richmond Hill, such an incredible turnout to these meetings, which was all inspired, frankly, by, I think, what was a very clever gimmick. But the technique started to work, and so Richmond Hill came on side and said, we'll oppose this subdivision, practically unheard of. The TRCA said, well, if you're opposed, we've got to be opposed, because this is a very sensitive, you know, recharge area. We've got provincially significant wetlands and so on and so forth. It's kind of an emerging concept. So York Region actually opposed a subdivision in Richmond Hill, which is practically unheard of. And the coup de grace was when the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing, led by that radical extreme environmentalist Premier Mike Harris, intervened in the hearing as a party to oppose a subdivision. Just never been heard of. So I'm sure she wouldn't mind saying, but you know, Glenda Bearmaker was working bingos in those days, and their budget was, you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars. They had practically speaking nothing. Extremely effective with the media, but had no real chops when it came to dealing with foundations, because they were too extreme, or they were just plain marginalized. There wasn't a culture fit. But I will say Nan Shuttleworth and the Salamander Foundation, she'll probably be cross with me for saying this, sent them some cash, and it was $15,000 or $20,000. Well, that was probably double their annual budget. And with that budget, they were able, I think that was what funded actually cutting down those little sections of trees that they sent out as invitations to the meeting. Or it was something else that pulled people out to the first night of the public hearing. But it was a critical intervention at a critical juncture in the land use wars in Southern Ontario that actually allowed Save the Rouge to be a full party at the hearing, to hold the TRCA's feet to the fire when they want to settle for a 75-meter buffer, to really play a role in that hearing, but more importantly, to play a role in the public relations campaign, and the media in particular. The Toronto Star took that on as a cause celeb. They attended the hearing every single day. They made the Oak Ridge Marina to be one of the most important environmental issues facing Ontarians, and it was, because embedded in it was air quality, public transportation,
water, agriculture, the watershed.
Watershed, yeah. Species, everything. So the day that hearing started, I was counseled to Save the Rouge with Alan Heisey. The day that hearing started was the day after, because I think Walkerton, that rainfall happened on a weekend, right? It was like a long weekend.
In May
2000. Mm. And I'm pretty sure our first hearing day was like May 29th. Mm. And I remember going to this thing and saying, whoa, that was, you know, because what had happened in Young East, Young West, up in Richmond Hill, was it had an erosion event because of the severity of the thunderstorm. And we were trying to make a point that you've got to go out and survey the land, because we've had so much water runoff. There's been some erosion, this will prove to you how this system is all interconnected, all this, not realizing that one of the seminal environmental events in Ontario history had occurred simultaneously because of this rain event. And it, you know, it had a major impact on environmental policy for years and years and years to this very day. But I remember that hearing, you know, a year into the hearing, and it looked like the province was losing. And Mike Harris just said, I had enough. He interviewed, stayed the hearing. He introduced the Oak Ridges Marine Protection Act, which became the Oak Ridge Marine Conservation Act, and froze development and created protections over 470,000 acres in southern Ontario.